Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning, September the 19th. I want to thank you all for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you. However, wherever, whenever you listen to the show, it's always great to have you. We have 90 minutes today with three fantastic authors. We're going to kick it off with author Jeannie Ryan and her latest book, Charisma. Then we're going to go over to Ireland and talk with Jack Miller, and he's going to be talking to us about The Assassin's Keeper. And then we're going to have David Bell on, and we talked about David Bell and his book, Somebody I Used to Know. We've been talking about on the radio show for the last month, and we finally get on to speak with him, so it's going to be a very exciting time for us here. But let's just jump right into our first guest. She is author Jeannie Ryan. Her latest book is called Charisma. She has another book, which you might recognize the name. It is called Nerve. It has been picked up by Lionsgate. It has been filmed and should be out released in 2016. We're not really sure what kind of format it's going to happen. You just never know with Hollywood. But Jeannie, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, John.
So like we said, let's jump into Charisma first before we strike another nerve and go into that realm. So Charisma, it's your latest book, and it's out now. Why don't you let everybody know a little bit about what's going on?
Sure. Charisma is a young adult thriller, and it's about a teenage girl named Aislinn who is just cripplingly shy. It's getting in the way of her getting scholarships, making friends, going after the guy she really wants, and you know, even something simple like going to a party. And so she, being a little science geeky girl, works with a mentor at a local company or organization that does gene therapy, who's also been helping her little brother with a genetic disease. And she's offered the opportunity for a gene therapy that will affect personality and give her a rock star personality. So she's kind of seduced, kind of coerced into taking it, and she does, and it delivers on the personality, but it also comes with really dangerous side effects. And she and some other teens who have accepted this gene therapy need to find a cure.
Now, of course, the term YA has always been, associated with, I guess you want to say, maybe some high middle schoolers through high schools and this, you know, maybe not so much college in this. But now the YAs that are coming out now, and of course your book, is very more educated in that realm. So the demographics have changed. Do you agree with maybe the type of readers that you find read your books?
Absolutely. I get contacted by just as many adults as I do teens. If you go to any bookstore event, you'll see the audiences are primarily or at least half adult. So it's definitely a crossover genre for sure now. And it's what I like to read, too. I'd say half of what I read is YA these days. So, because it's fun, it's fast-paced, and it touches on issues that we all care about. So, yeah.
Yeah, it almost seems that YA now is just the amount of just the age of the main character that's in the book, and then someone calls it a YA. But with the science and the amount of, like I said, sophistication and intelligence that you have in your book, is that difficult when you're writing something like that because you are trying to remember that these are, you know, young adults in your book character-wise, and not to make them, I guess, too adult because then that might take away from the overall effect of what you're trying to do?
Somewhat. I mean, I think in terms of the science I present. You know, I think I want to give it enough to be meaty, but not so that it's dry. And I think I would do that for an adult book too. But the way my character might be making decisions or experiencing life is going to be more as a teen, because there's still a lot of firsts. And I think, you know, everything felt more dramatic, I think, when I was a teenager. But
yes, it does.
Yeah. So I think it's just kind of taking that perspective that makes it more young adult than adult. But, you know, I think that the science would have to be balanced whatever age you're writing for, unless you're writing to an audience that is really going to crave the super detailed scientific facts, which this book is a thriller, not the science text. So I didn't feel like I needed to go quite to that level.
Right, because one of the reviews had said that this is like Robin Cook, which, of course, he's very much into the medical. Just kind of jump into your main character. And is it Aislinn?
Aislinn.
Tell
mm-hmm.
us about her. Who is she? I mean, I guess, you know, why was she the one that you decided to pick as the person that was going to lead this story? What makes her so fascinating? Who is she?
Well, she's a really brainy girl, and I like, you know, showing brainy girls in YA, and you know, she's got, I think, a lot of substance. She's got a lot at stake because a lot of kids who grow up with a sibling or even a parent that's got a serious disease. In her case, her little brother has cystic fibrosis. I think they grow up faster and are more mature in some ways because they have to be. And so she's got a lot at stake with her little brother. And I think one of my favorite things about her is her relationship with him. It's, you know, and on the one hand, she feels very protective. But on the other, he's an old soul too, so they complement each other. And she's someone who knows what she wants but just can't bring herself to get beyond a certain a disability or challenge. And I could relate to her because in high school I was painfully shy. I mean, teacher would call on me and I would just melt. So I could draw on that. Thankfully, I'm not quite that bad now, but I could draw on just wanting and aching to be able to be heard but just not being able to find your voice. So that that really appealed to me with her character.
Now, of course, when you're writing, YA and you're writing into the teenage realm, like you said, you have to kind of put yourself back into that high school kind of mentality. But with the way that things, of course, have changed from when we were that age until, you know, the age now, how much research do you have to do just in the fact of knowing the age group now compared to what it was like when we were that age?
I think you definitely need to keep current and have a feel for what's important. I'm very lucky. I have a teenager in my household, and I have nephews and nieces, and just being around schools, you know, with my kids' schools, you know, volunteering as a parent, I'm around kids and teens all the time. So I think that's important. And also, as you know, social media, I think, really helps a lot too. You can't escape it, really, and just keeping current with what kids care about. You know, and I know I'm still not one now, so there's only so far I can go. But I also read a lot of YA too, so I think it is important because, you know, it's, I think you can smell a fake a mile away, right? So
right.
I think you've got to care about that environment too and care about those topics, which I do. So I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, that's one of the things, because I always look at my – because I have four children, and my youngest is 18, but I've had to go through, of course, from my oldest is 23 to 18. And, yes, we were quick and doing our stuff. But the thing is is I sit there and I see today, and I always laugh because I see the selfies and I see everything that's online and they're telling everybody what they're doing. And I go, when I was your age, I didn't want anybody knowing what I was doing. I go, I don't understand why you want to share everything with everybody. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I always just shake my head. And so I always find that funny. And I think that, and maybe you do the same thing when you start looking at writing characters in today's day and age, you just kind of laugh like, this would have never happened when I was going to school. It would have been a much different book if I was writing characters back then.
Oh, totally. And, you know, the online sharing. Well, you've just basically described one of the things that spurred me to write my first book, Nerve, is the oversharing of everything and then how it can possibly be used against you. You know, and I took it to a total thrillery, almost paranoid extreme, but, you know, the whole notion of privacy has changed. And there's a researcher, he was one of the top researchers at Google, he might still be there, and was also a professor named Andrea Weigand, and he's got a quote saying, maybe privacy was just a blip in history, that, you know, we used to be in small villages where everybody knew everybody's business, and then we grew to these large industrial cities where you could have some anonymity, but now with social media, we're kind of back to the small village. I mean, it's a much bigger village, but the idea of losing track of somebody, like there were a lot of people from high school or college I lost track of, but can you imagine kids now losing track of anybody? Because, you know, there's always a connection, right?
Exactly. And I think that that's part of the thing that, you know, that they don't really understand is that fact of, hey, when we graduated high school and people went to college, if you didn't really have their number, their parents or things like that, they were gone. That was it. They were out of sight, out of mind. You weren't really going to see them again unless you bumped into them somehow, because there was not that instantaneous texting them on the cell phone, hitting them up on Facebook or whatever you wanted to do. So I find it very interesting just to see that dynamic kind of change with school kids. I find that interesting. But now that you kind of mentioned the book Nerve, let's get into it and let everybody know, I guess, a little bit about the book and then the journey of how it now became picked up by Lionsgate to be filmed and how was all that and how was that experience?
So Nerve is, as I've alluded to, very much about an online experience, and it's about an online game of dares that you can play to win bigger and bigger prizes. And the dares are filmed by watchers who can pay to, you know, be in-person watchers, and if they catch good footage, they can earn money too. So you can start off, in this case, my main character, V, who, she's not shy, but, she, you know, she's kind of the good girl, the behind-the-scenes, the play, the makeup girl. She is lured into playing and just starting off with really silly kind of tawdry dares, and then is offered bigger prizes, and then threatened into getting into some very dangerous dares. So that's in a nutshell Nerve, and you can guess that it was inspired by, you know, reality TV as well as just watching my niece on her cell phone and how much of a teen's life is lived over the phone these days. And so in terms of it getting picked up for a movie, you know, I had very little to do with that. It's one of these kind of lightning hits scenarios. I was checking email, and I had this message, just like a one-liner, asking if I'd sold the rights, film rights yet to the book, and I just kind of, you know, nudged my husband and said, oh, you know, that's kind of interesting. I wonder, you know, I guess somebody is wondering if it's going to be a movie. And he pointed to the computer and said, look at the return address. And it was, you know, Lionsgate.com. So my literary agency works with a screen rights agency in Hollywood. And so, you know, right away we got everybody involved, and they went from there, and we went through negotiation process and, you know, kind of going through all the details. And then, you know, every author is told or learns along the way that, you know, it's so rare to get a book optioned, because that's the first step, is basically they call dibs, and for like 18 months is a standard length of time. And not to get your hopes up, it's fun to dream, but that most books that get optioned don't then become film. And so, sure, I try not to keep my hopes up, but, you know, you're in Hollywood, right? You know, it's fun to dream. And, of course, I dreamt, and I guess it was probably a year and a half after the book came out that they announced they had attached directors, the guys who had directed Catfish, a movie which I loved and definitely has that creepy internet vibe. And then a few months later, they announced that Emma Roberts and Dave Franco would be the stars. And I had a chance to fly out to New York this past May and see a little bit of the filming and some of the dailies. And it looks fantastic. I can't wait till it's out.
Yeah, the one thing I think that a lot of maybe just a lot of people don't understand is true. You know, maybe 5% of all the books that are optioned ever become movies. The major authors, like Lee Child, heck, Jack Reacher, he had out for years, and then it finally became a movie after so long. You know, Tess Gerritsen, Rizzoli and Isles became a TV show. So all those things are kind of, you know, and it's great that you're able to kind of see your book kind of come to life on the screen and how it works. But the one thing that I don't think a lot of readers understand is, like you said, you didn't have a lot of input probably into the process. They might have asked you questions about this and that, but their screen, you know, when they wrote the screenplay for it, that was just something that they just took the book as the guide and the framework, and then they do it as they want to do it. And you really don't have a lot of say in that. Am I correct?
Yes, you're right. You know, I think an author like John Green or J.K. Rowling, who has, you know, these huge blockbuster hit books, I'm sure they get some creative control. But, yeah, for, you know, an author like me, debut book, no, I do not get creative control. And there's a great quote, I'm paraphrasing it, by Catherine Ryan Hyde, who wrote Pay It Forward, that was turned into a movie. And she said, never confuse your book with their movie. So, it's a, you know, yes, it's going to be their vision based on your book. And I think that's really wise advice.
Yeah.
But I think the movie's going to be good.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Jeannie Ryan. You can go to JeannieRyan.com for more information on her current book, Charisma. Check out the book, Nerve, now that it's going to be a film in 2016, and see what's going on with that. Now, was Nerve your debut book?
Yes, it was.
So you want
not
to talk about
the first book written,
but the debut in this kind of young adult series?
It was my debut book that was published. It was the fifth book I wrote. So I guess you know, for people thinking it, you know, the whole overnight success thing, it most authors don't publish their first book, and so for me it was the fifth, but it was the first one published. So yeah, to get the movie, like you said, it's pretty
hard.
Hitting
grand slam. It's like walking up to the plate for the first time in the majors, hitting a grand slam. Bam, there you go. What's next?
But, yeah, it's surreal. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's not all this easy. And you're like, wow, this is, I don't know what the big deal is. Write a book, sell it, make a movie. Let's do the next one.
Well, I would, you know, it's funny because, you know, I wanted my kids to come with me to the set in New York, because they saw the before the book came out, they saw the 8 years of writing, they saw all the books that were rejected, they saw the 100 rejections just to get an agent, and so they know that it's, you know, it's not just stepping up to the plate. You know, they got to see all the tears, the movie is just this amazing icing on the cake.
Now, is young adult the genre that you see yourself staying in for quite some time, or do you have ideas to kind of jump out and do something maybe more adult, or do a different kind of you know, a different kind of book and a different kind of genre.
I foresee staying in young adult because I've written manuscripts. You know, I wrote adult and middle grade and even picture book. You know, I tried all the age ranges, and the one that just fit my voice the best and just my sensibility with in terms of what I like in terms of pacing. The young adult is a really good fit for me, and I like the excitement of all those firsts, and just that time of life is, you know, a really interesting one to explore. And because it's got such great crossover appeal, I kind of feel like I'm, you know, getting the best of both worlds by writing in that age range. So, you know, if an idea comes to me that's absolutely another age range, whether it's older or younger, you know, I'll go with it. But right now, that seems to be what speaks to me.
Now, is there something that when you wrote Nerve, and like you said, it was your first book that you published, was it something about that one from the previous five that you had done, challenged yourself, you realized your mistakes, and you sat there and then you made this book, you know, that much better? And a lot of authors maybe don't realize that that's kind of what it takes, is to kind of learn from mistakes and understand points of view and understand a lot of those little things that are, I guess, you know, that make a book complete. How mm-hmm. was that learning process for you going through up and then finally getting your book published and then realizing all the time, wow, you know, if I just would have known this at the beginning, maybe the process wouldn't have been so long and so difficult.
Yeah, you know, it definitely is cumulative. I wish it were now easy, but you know, it's still quite a struggle to get through a book. But with Nerve, the breakthrough for me was before that I focused a lot on character, which is important, but I didn't really get plotting. I really didn't understand that a plotting structure, and I ended up using screenplay structure, and you know, people can look up what that is. But there's many of them. There's the Blake Snyder beat sheets. There's 8-point, 10-point screenplay structure. But really, learning the value of a plotting structure, and Nerve was the first novel I really got that with. And also I had a high concept, and, you know, that's just basically you can describe the plot in a sentence or two. And when I wrote it, I turned to my husband. I said, this is the one. This is the one that's going to get published, because it just finally all clicked for me. But, yeah, it took hopefully other people can do it in less than five manuscripts. But for me, it took writing those other ones and just studying constantly before that all came together.
So I guess you want to say what's next. You know, what can fans expect to see coming up now after Charisma? And are you thinking of writing maybe into a series, or are you going to stay with standalones?
You know, that's a good question. The book I'm working on now, it's not officially in the works. It's still my book, you know, so it's not under contract. And I'm experimenting with magical realism. So I don't know how that'll go, you know, changing genres after two thrillers. But I found that a lot of my favorite books recently have been magical realism. So I just really wanted to challenge myself and give it a try. And I think the success of Nerve in the movie gave me the confidence to, you know, step out of the thriller and into something I just really wanted to give a go. So we'll see whether that works or not, if anybody else likes it. But for now, I'm having a lot of fun writing it. So that's, you know, you've got to follow your muse too.
That's true. Well, we got about a minute left, and so I guess the best way is just to kind of give it to you on the floor, to kind of let everybody know how they can get in contact with you, you know, whether your website, all the social media and everything else you have going on. So I kind of leave that last minute up to you to kind of give all that information out.
Okay, great. Well, you've mentioned my website at jeannieryan.com. I also have a Facebook author page that you can just write my name and author, and I put events on there. I'll be doing a couple things in the Seattle area in October, in Seattle and in Puyallup, and then also be at the Vegas Valley Book Festival in Las Vegas mid-October. So that should be a lot of fun. People can come out and say hi.
Well, we want to thank you so much for coming on, Jeannie. And a lot of people don't know that this was short notice that we had yesterday because we had another guest that was going to come on, had to cancel. So it was great that you were able to fill in. And it was a wonderful conversation. So, again, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad it all worked out schedule-wise. It's been a lot of fun. And I look forward to hearing your other authors talk.
Wonderful. And I'm waiting for one to call in, Jack Miller from Ireland, so we'll wait and see. And David Bell, we've never spoken with him, but we've done a lot of reviews, so he should be a great interview too. So thanks so much, and we enjoy.
Okay, take care.
Bye. So again, anyway, that is author Jeannie Ryan, and the book is called Charisma, but don't forget the book Nerve, which is going to be a feature-length film in 2016 from Lionsgate. Go to jeannieryan.com for more information on that and all of her and all the works and everything that's going to be updated into the future. They also want to let you know, of course, about Kensington Publishing and what they have going on. You go to kensingtonbooks.com. Lisa Jackson, Kevin O'Brien, Daniel Palmer, Shane Yerke, just a couple of authors that they have on their stable with some outstanding books that have come out now. We want to make sure that you hit Kensington Publishing, because we always say check the publisher just as much as the author, because it's a very important thing for you to know who the publisher is. Because some publishers just don't put out quality work. Some people don't, you know, some publishers in today's day and age, everything is popping up. There's no editing. There's no really working. And you're going to spend your money on stuff that's not going to have good books. So you want to stick with publishers that still might do the old-fashioned game. They still might, they still are editing books. They're still very specific on what books that they put out. Like what we do at Suspense Publishing, we receive hundreds of submissions, but we maybe do only 10% of everything that we get in because some things just are not ready. So the publisher is a very important thing to look at when you're searching for a book. So make sure that you check that out. We are going to take a short break, and we will be back with our next guest. Hopefully he will be calling in. I'm not sure about the time. This always scares me when I have somebody calling in from the UK because the time things can get a little messed up. But his name is Jax Miller. He was born and raised in New York, but now he lives in Ireland. So it's going to be interesting to see what accent he comes out with, because that I'm not sure about. But his latest book is called Freedom's Child, and so we're going to be hearing about that, hopefully. So in the meantime, we will play a little bit of music, and you can hear this. Be right back. Down. So welcome back, everybody, after the break. We are still waiting on author Jack Miller to call in. What I thought I would do, instead of me just sitting here blabbering for 30 minutes until the next guest comes on, Dave Bell, we do have some Thriller Fest interviews that we've been playing on Beyond the Cover, but maybe you've not heard them all. So what I thought I would do is I would go ahead and I would play some of the interview that we have here. And if you haven't heard it, it's wonderful. And we are going to pick somebody from the UK. One of our friends, of course, one of the wonderful author, international bestseller all over the world, except here in the United States, which we're not really sure why. But it's author Peter James, and he is a fantastic author, of course, the author of the Roy Grace series. So here's Peter James from Thriller. Me and Jeff Ayers are the ones that are speaking with him, and we will cut in and cut this interview if Jax is able to get through and call us. Otherwise, you will be able to hear Peter James from Thriller Fest 2015. Here you go. At least I thought it was going to play. Don't you love live radio? It just doesn't work sometimes, does it? So I thought I was going to have Peter James on. Oh, let's try this again. Here we go. And it looks like it's not working. Let's jump to another. Let's go over here to Jamie Frevoletti. We got another. I got them all queued up. Let's see what we can play here. And let's go with Jamie Frevoletti from Thriller Fest, and let's see if this one works.
So we're here with Jamie Frevoletti at Thriller Fest. Jamie, thanks so much. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm having a great time.
Good. Now, you did a craft fest morning for Lorenzo. I can never pronounce his last name.
Cascatia.
But you weren't supposed to, but you're always here at Thriller Fest. This is the 10th anniversary, so it's kind of a big deal with them. So what does Thriller Fest mean to you as an author?
Well, I was here at the very first Thriller Fest. I went to Arizona, and anyone who went there will know it was kind of magical. And so I've been at every Thriller Fest since. When I first started, I was unpublished, was looking for an agent. And I actually had been picked up from the slush pile, I think, two Thriller Fests later. And the agent was going to be here. And we had been talking about my manuscript, and then we were actually able to meet personally here, talk about things, and she ended up telling me if I made a couple of changes, she'd take the book. So Thriller Fest was kind of instrumental in getting me a face-to-face meeting with my agent. Mm-hmm. So, and I've come every year because I always get a good tip. There's, even as a published writer now, I listen to people, and I always go away with some new insight into something.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because, I mean, in just in 10 years, look how fast you've come, and you still are learning. You're always constantly learning. So you find something from somebody, whether it's because Thriller Fest is broken up. You have Craft Fest, you have Thriller Fest, so you have something for everybody. And when a new author comes, like yourself, you know, 10 years ago, what were the expectations that you had going into it, and has it changed now that it's been 10 years and Thriller Fest has kind of changed?
Well, My first time I went was the very first time this organization had a conference, and I was excited because I was writing thrillers. And I thought it was finally a conference just for thriller writers that I could actually meet other people. I could make some networks and contact some networking within the industry. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly that. It's always been that. So I use the Thriller Fest conference for a one-stop shop. I can see I'm published by two people. I've been published by HarperCollins and Grand Central. So I have a lot of editors. I have a lot of, you know, publishers. And I can see everybody here. So for me, I try to come every year just to do my meet and greet with everybody. We kind of catch up. And then, as you say, I try to get here for Craft Fest so I can kind of peek in. And mm-hmm. either I teach a class now, or I try to listen to other people because I'm always learning. And one thing about Thriller Fest Conference is I think there are so many different tracks for so many different people that you could always find something.
And now that they have a pitch fest, that's something that they didn't have back when you started. So if you're an author and you were to see something like that, what advice would you give somebody to come in while they're pitching? Because you've had to pitch before, maybe not in a room for a bunch of people, But what's an advice that you would give a new author that is attending for PitchFest to try to become published?
Okay, I have had to pitch in a room. Before I came to Thriller Fest, there was a small festival in Aurora, Illinois, of all places. And this is a little shout-out to small festivals. If you can get to one in your town, do it. You'd be always be surprised who you'll meet there. But they had a 90-second pitch. You had to stand up on stage, take a microphone. You had 60 seconds to pitch your book, the premise of your book. I would tell everybody listening that if they come here for that, try and shoot for that 60-second mark. Practice it in front of a mirror. I had a girlfriend with me at that conference. I ran in the back hallway, and she worked me through some of the. I had an idea that I thought was good, and we really tailored it down. And be prepared to give that 60-second pitch at PitchFest here. Now, I will be sitting at a table today. I guess they want me to listen to pitches, and I just love it because I, again, learn from that what's the highlight of your book and how can you pitch it verbally. I'm hoping to hit L.A. shortly, and I may have to pitch a teleplay.
Oh.
And if I pitch that, it's going to be the same thing. Log line, what's the story about?
Yeah. Now let's get to your writing because you said you have two publishers. For somebody that's kind of listening, they're like, why do you have two publishers? I mean, you know, how does that dynamic thing kind of work?
Yeah, clarify that. I'd say I have my own series, Running from the Devil, that was published by HarperCollins. Mm-hmm. And then while I was working on that series, the state of Robert Ludlum hired me to write not his Bourne series. He created Jason Bourne, but his Covert One series. And so that's published by a different house. That's published by Grand Central. So, you know, it's been an interesting thing to see two different very large houses and how they approach publishing books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been only great for me because I can pick and see what I like and how things work. And I have to say, I'm charmed to have such great, you know, professionals around me.
Now, were you shocked when they contacted you? Was it something out of the blue for the Ludlum estate to kind of contact you and say, you know, did they read a certain book? Was it a certain character or something that got them onto you?
You know, I don't know the full details. It was a very secretive process, but they had picked 10 authors, some New York Times bestsellers, down to me. And at the time, I was just debut with Running from the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the mix. Then they got down to three, and I still didn't know about it till they got down to three. And I won the ITW Best Novel Award here, Best First Novel. And after I got off the stage, my agent took me in the bathroom. I was crying. My mascara was a mess. I was so excited.
That was your Oscar moment. You're like, yes.
Moment. And she said, well, what do you think of Robert Ludlum? I'm like, I'm not thinking about him right now, you know. But she told me you're one of three, and I didn't want to get your hopes up when you were one of 10, but now it's starting to look, you won this award.
Yeah.
A few months later, I won that Barry Award at Boucher Con for the same novel, and they were in the bar. And the agent came up to me later, and she said, the state of Robert Ludlum, the representatives are in the bar, and they'd like to meet with you. So then I knew I was pretty much a done deal.
Yeah.
They asked me to present something, an idea that I would do, and I did, and then I got the job.
Nice.
So it was very exciting.
So now, what are you working on now on your series?
Okay,
series
I just finished the Geneva Strategy, which came out February 3rd. That's Robert Ludlum's Covert One.
Okay.
So that came out February 3rd. So that's in the can. And usually those are written, I write 1 year for them, and then Kyle Mills picks up.
Okay.
He writes a year, then I write a year. So that's done. Emma, I have at 75,000 words. My Emma books run about 94,000, so I got 20,000 more to write, and I'm in meetings actually in about next month with regard to a distributor and a publisher for Emma. I'm moving Emma. Emma is going to move from HarperCollins.
Oh, okay.
But I also have a standalone I just wrote called Buddha's Black Soul. Ooh, maybe I shouldn't have given the title. Anyway, that might not be the title, guys, because
it's an arc. Wait till it hits the shelf.
It's in submission, but I just gave that to my agent, and HarperCollins is going to take a look. They may have first dibs to look at that one, but that one's going to go out wide.
That sounds
historical,
too.
We're going to submit. It's very interesting. It's not historical, but it's very interesting. So that one is on submission, so that means that my agent has it, and we'll see who decides they want to buy it.
Nice. And those are kind of the fun things, I guess, you're able to explore as a writer. You're able to kind of step outside and see different things and not kind of be stuck maybe into one thing where your publisher's like, no, you got to write 3 books on this character and that's all we want.
Yeah.
So how is that exciting? And is it difficult to change tones and to do different things with the different books, you know, with the Ludlum series, your own series, and jumping around?
You know, honestly, in this day and age, anyone who's listening, I would say, this day and age, authors write pretty much 2 books a year.
You'd
be apparently not that way. I've never had the luxury of only writing one a year, but 2 books a year is a lot for anybody. So Ludlum, when Ludlum comes, I take it. And that's why Emma got kind of pushed to the put on the back burner for a minute, so I got Ludlum done, because
mm-hmm.
they're usually on a very strict schedule. Because of this other author,
right.
they don't, you know, I can't slow him down. And then I really think at this stage, it's nice. I know Emma so well, and I know the Covert One character so well. Those two are fine. I can write
mm-hmm.
those. Getting this third standalone, Buddhist Black Soul Gun, has been a challenge because it's brand new protagonist. And honestly, it's very exciting, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me a chance to kind of stretch again, which I need to have, I think, as a creative person. However, I got to fit that time in.
Yep.
So it's a little bit tight, and I'm not that fast of a writer. I write a book about every 9 months.
Okay.
And the slowest, the quickest I've ever written has been 4 months.
Wow.
That was an unusual circumstance where the book just was in my head. I just knew exactly what was going to happen. But that's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
My usual is about 9 months, and some people would say that's pretty slow. I think it's actually kind of fast, but...
Yeah, 4 months, that seems pretty
quick. Well, 4 months was really fast.
Yes,
nine months,
that's about average, I think, from just
now
listening.
Now it's average. I'm hearing people say it's average, but to me it feels fast. I don't know.
Yeah, that's about average.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just because, I don't really know why the reason, but, you know, like Stephen James, he goes, I had to cut back, I couldn't do that many. He goes, people were like, do this and this. He goes, look, I'm going to do one YA, which is kind of easier for him to do. And he goes, and then just one other. He goes, I can't do it those fast. You just don't want to throw something out there and just have it out there. You always want to put your best foot forward.
I know, guys. Excuse me. I know authors who are writing 3 books a year, and they're just fast. They have ideas, and you know they write in the airport, they write in the coffee shop, wherever
mm-hmm.
they are. They bring a laptop and they write. I have kids and I have other things going on where I can't always just have a laptop at my disposal, and if I did, I think it would help.
Mm-hmm.
But I also tend to be kind of the person who wants to be in front of my station, my little work area. I tend to
your
be
comfort
that.
Zone.
Yeah, I wake up at 6 or 7,
yeah.
have my coffee, sit down and write. I have my routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the really fast writers are able to write without that routine. They're able to write anywhere, which I kind of admire. I'm going to try and work on expanding my abilities in that regard.
Well, we know you got to get to a book signing, so let's just figure out. So where's the best place people can find everything out about what you're doing?
All right, go to my website, www.jamiefrabelletti.com. It's just my name, jamiefrabelletti.com. Everything should be on there. I'm going to be revamping the site in August, but it will be up most of the time, I think, during the revamp.
And then besides Thriller Fest, are you doing anything else for the rest of the year, conference-wise, where people can find you?
Yes, I will be teaching a class at Story Studio on thriller writing in Chicago. And in October, I have 2 signings in Chicago, and then I also go to BoucherCon, which I believe is
in Raleigh, yes.
North Carolina this year.
Nice. Well, Jamie, we want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day, and we'll catch you,
doing
it.
Great to see you.
All right.
Thanks.
So, again, everybody, that is author Jamie Frabelletti from Thriller Fest 2015. Again, Jax Miller has not been able to call in. We're going to have to find out what it is. But we have about 16 minutes left before David Bell comes on. We can do a little bit of Hank Philippine Ryan's interview at Thriller Fest. It goes a little bit longer than that, but we'll have to cut it off. So here is Hank Philippine Ryan from Thriller Fest 2015 as interviewed by John Robb and Jeff Ayers. I believe Jeff was there. I don't remember, but I think he was. But here we go anyway.
So Jeff and I are here again at Thriller Fest with Hank Philippine Ryan. Hank,
hey.
Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
So first question we've been asking all the authors is, how special and what does Thriller Fest mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. I remember the first time I came to Thriller Fest, which I can't even remember how long ago that was. It was my first book, and I was so excited, and I walked into the hotel, and it was just teeming with every famous author I could ever imagine. And I was a little overwhelmed. I thought, how am I supposed to make myself known in this room full of people who are brilliant and successful and powerful, and this, you know, I felt like the new kid, like absolutely a new kid. And I think people who are coming to Thriller Fest for the first time need to sort of embrace that that is hilarious, that they're lucky to be in this group, they're lucky to share the joy of having written a book or learning how to write a book, and that right here in this one little hotel is everything they could ever know. It is just a glorious supermarket full of information and knowledge and experience and genuine affection. I mean, people... My advice would be, don't be afraid to talk to someone. Don't be afraid to go up to someone. Don't be afraid to connect with your favorite author, you know, obviously in a respectful, polite way. And with,
well,
you, with and yeah, you're a problem. Jeff, you're a problem. That's, everybody talks about it.
That's why we have them behind the screen, people.
I wonder why.
That's why we do that.
The other thing is that when you're writing, you are so alone. You're in your little office or wherever you write by yourself, and you think, I'm the only one who feels this way. I'm the only one who's having trouble. I'm the only one who doesn't know what I'm doing. And you come to a place like this, and you realize everybody has the same feeling. So we write alone, but coming to a conference like this proves we're not alone. So you can turn to anybody, you know, from the best-selling author to the newbiest of newbie who is sitting by you, and talk about anything. You know, this is, it's just a wonderful opportunity to, all you have to do is say to a new person, what are you working on? How are you? Where are you from? And boom, you're in a conversation. So it's no holds barred, and it's quite marvelous. It can be a little overwhelming,
yeah,
you know.
That's what I was gonna, yeah.
And I do think, just don't be put off by that. You know, again, think you're not the only one who feels overwhelmed. Everybody feels overwhelmed. And just go for it. You know, just you'll have a, I promise you, and I'd love your listeners to email me and tell me what it is, because everyone will has one fabulous, memorable experience every Thriller Fest. There's always this gem of a gorgeous story that they'll take home.
I completely agree with that. I'm curious, because I have a problem with this sometimes. You talk about the solitary aspect of writing, but then you come to a place like this here, and then you're sociable all of a sudden. Can you talk a bit about that switch?
somebody once told me that one of the situations that occurs at these conventions is that you have 2,000 people who'd rather be by themselves, all forced to be in a place where they have to talk to each other. You know, and so everyone feels the same. Everybody's curious. Everyone's interested. Everybody's, you know, frankly, kind of comparing what everybody else is doing. And you kind of get the, forgive me for this, but you kind of get the author zeitgeist. So even though we are, I mean, I'm such a, if I say introvert, I know, Jeff, you're going to laugh, but totally true. If someone said, do you want to go to a party or do you want to stay home? I'm like, I guess I'd rather stay home. And I bet so many people at this convention feel just the same way. But here we all are together. Here we are. And it just doesn't matter. For one fabulous weekend, you know, we all get to talk about books and thrillers and writing and experience and fears and loves, and it's great.
Now, you go to many different conferences, of course, not just Thriller Fest, but there's several that go on, and there's almost one a month. It seems like you have the one in BoucherCon and Killer Nashville and Malice and Left Coast Crime. How is this one different? Because some of those seem to be more fan. This is a little bit more, I guess, professional. Because you see, how is it different for you when you come into here?
I think Thriller Fest is glittery. I think, you know, Thriller Fest is sort of, it always feels very polished. And you're exactly right about professional. I mean, these are the pros who are here. And these are the thriller writers. You know, these are the fast-paced, page-turning, suspense-writing men and women who know what they're doing and have experience and have information and have a goal. It moves. It's very New York. I mean, this conference is very New York. It moves fast. And I think that's how it's different. Some, you know, a smaller writers conference may be more laid back or traditional or a little quieter. I mean, I've been to conferences where the bar is empty at 10.
Not here.
I don't think it ever empties here.
I agree.
People just come down and go to panels at 8 a.m.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and by late Sunday afternoon, there are a lot of groggy-looking people. But that's part of the thing. I mean, I think it's fun. It's fast-paced. It's It's a big deal. Thriller Fest is big, don't you think?
Yeah,
I would agree for sure. I have to ask about the new book because I haven't seen a galley yet. So
they just arrived on my doorstep.
Okay.
Well, it comes out in October. Like, I think it's the 12th or 15th, right around there.
Yeah, it's the 20th.
The 20th, okay.
And thank you for making me say that. That's great.
Yes.
October 20th. It's called What You See. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited about it. I just got a call from Lisa Unger, who said, I couldn't put it down. So that's a high accolade.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about all the surveillance, it's the next Jane Ryland novel.
Number four. So people know.
Yeah,
you can read them
I
in any
Jane.
Order. Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. She's a reporter in Boston.
Not that you know anything about that.
No.
Yeah. Well, you went on a limb with that one.
I did. I scraped the bottom.
That's a lot of research.
Exactly. Well, people say to me, do you do a lot of research for your Jane Ryland books? And I say, I've been doing research for 40 years. I got this Boston investigative reporter thing down pat. So you can read them in any order. It's a series of standalones.
Mm-hmm.
Book four, the fourth Jane book, is called What You See. It's about, all the surveillance that is everywhere these days. Everywhere we go, someone is taking our picture in this hotel. I'm sure we're on surveillance video. Hello. All the time. Certainly in the street, certainly in restaurants, certainly in stores, certainly in hotels, certainly everywhere there's cameras. And somebody is recording exactly where we are and what we're doing all the time. And we know this. We've seen the Ray Rice videos, and we see the videos of the actor trashing the hotel room.
And just the new Florida State quarterback, if you haven't seen that one, just at a bar, a little dinky thing in a bar, the Florida State quarterback literally just punched this girl right on camera, and of course they dismissed him. But, I mean, Ray Rice was at least an elevator that you would know that there's a camera. This, it's like you would have no idea there would even be a camera there.
Well, what about Ariana Grande and the licking the donuts? I mean,
right.
I'm sorry, I hope we're not talking about that anymore. But
thanks for joining us today.
And then we're done. But the thing that got me thinking about those surveillance cameras when it comes to writing a great thriller and a page-turning story is that what about you and me and you and everyone in your family, and we're all on video too, and all that video is someplace, and someone has access to all of it. And what might somebody do with that? What could somebody do if they looked at it and scoped it out and figured out who was who and who was where and what they were doing and when they shouldn't have been there? Not famous people, but just you and me. And what might they do with some of that information? And that's what You See is about.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of tyranny of constant surveillance, what we give up, we give up our privacy, and sometimes it solves crimes, and that's the Jake part. The other main character in the Jane Ryland books is Jake Brogan, who's a Boston police detective, and he...
Better put them together, I'm just saying.
Jake and Jane are madly in love with each other, but they can't be together. She's a reporter, and he's a source, and so never the twain shall meet, at least by book four, and... Jake. Oh, spoiler alert. Although there's something unusual that happens, so you'll love it, Jeff.
Oh, okay.
Jake is called to the scene of a stabbing, a murder, in the middle of Curly Park, which is right outside Quincy Market, Faneuil Hall in Boston, a big tourist attraction in Boston. It's noon, it's almost July 4th. Someone is stabbed to death right in broad daylight in the midst of the public, and of course, the tourists are all taking pictures of it. So there are pictures of the murder, and the point of What You See is you think, well, the cops will be able to solve this. There are pictures of the guy holding the knife in the guy's back, in the victim's back. But what you see is not always the truth, and so even though with the pictures of a murder, Jake has to figure out what really happened and what's really behind those pictures, and how... Even with surveillance and even with the photograph, you can't really know the truth without going deeper than that.
Yeah, I would think that if somebody was following me, they'd be like, "Well, we don't have to identity theft him because he is boring." But what you touch on is something very, and it's almost when you think about it, it can be very scary, because there's eyes everywhere. You're being followed everywhere. I mean, just last night, there was a picture of me and Reavers Worth, and we're just joking around. He gets me today, and he goes, "Someone put it on Facebook."
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" And so it doesn't take that long. And then once it's out there, even if you delete it, someone could have grabbed it, and then it's gone. And I don't think people realize that. So when you're exploring those things with Jane and your character, do you find some disturbing facts that you're like, I didn't even know this existed, and this really disturbs me?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. I've been a reporter for 40 years. I'm still on the air at the NBC affiliate in Boston. And one of the stories I did was about, it was some like minor story about jaywalking in Boston. When I go to other cities, people don't jaywalk, but in Boston, you just walk wherever you want to go. The cars have to stop, and they sometimes do and sometimes don't. So City Hall put up surveillance cameras at the intersections to watch for jaywalkers and to watch for traffic jams. And the traffic people use them to adjust the lights make the lights be red or green,
right,
and so they don't have traffic jams. So I go into this big surveillance room at City Hall to do a story about this, and I see this bank of many monitors on the wall, and there's surveillance cameras of everywhere. I mean, I can see down in Curley Park. I can see Quincy Market. I can see the hotel. I can see Channel 7. I can see the intersection of Congress Street and North Street, and I can see this. And I said, do lawyers ever subpoena this video? You know, if there was a traffic accident, if there was a drunk driving thing, if there was some sort of an incident, do lawyers ever subpoena the video that from these? And where do you keep that? And how do you keep it? And how long do you keep it? And they said, no, we don't keep it. We just see it live, but it's not recorded.
Okay.
So I thought, crime fiction author me, I'm like, oh right, you don't record it. And that's where that story came from.
Okay.
That's where that story came from. What could happen to that video and what they see from City Hall? And then Jake, the detective, realizes that this is what they're doing. So instead of going on a stakeout, I'm not giving too much away. Instead of going on a stakeout, he says, I'm going to go up into the City Hall surveillance room and watch from there. And someone says, you need a warrant to look at their computers. And he's like, no, I don't. I'm just looking out a window. It's just a really, really good window.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. So it's that line between privacy and the ubiquity of surveillance cameras and what someone might do with that, and what you might see. And now what's changed me is everywhere I go, I look to see if there's a camera.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go.
All these traffic cameras.
And they're all, you see those little white things with the little lenses,
mm-hmm,
everywhere. I mean, they're seeing us all the time. I love that. So from the standpoint of crime fiction, how suspenseful is that?
Built-in plot.
That someone is watching you,
yeah,
all the time. And who might use that? Who might use the knowledge that someone is watching you all the time on both sides of the camera?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the scary part.
Well, they even talk about those video game systems that, they scan your body.
The
Kinect. That supposedly because those are cameras, they're looking at you.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. About all that stuff.
I'm sorry I've made it worse now, but I think it is worse. I think it is worse.
Well, I guess, do you think we, with all the surveillance, are safer as a result, or are we even less safe?
Oh, good.
So there's your teaser. Now, there was still about 5 minutes left in that interview, and if you want to go over to Beyond the Cover and listen, we have played that interview along with the Jamie Frevoletti one and Robert Wilson on the show. You can listen to that. But David Bell is on the line, and we are grateful that we were able to speak with him. We've seen his books now for, Somebody I Used to Know. We had sat there and we had said that, of course, David is one of the brightest and best crime fiction writers of our time. We've been talking about Somebody I Used to Know for the last month on the radio shows, but now we're able to have the author right here talking about it. So, David, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, John.
So let's just jump into it, because we've been talking about the book so much. Your publisher, they'd given us some ad space and they sponsored the show for the month. And so we've been mentioning Somebody I Used to Know. But now let's hear about it. Give us the inside look into this book and let people know what they're going to get when they pick it up and read it.
Okay, well, Somebody I Used to Know is a suspense novel, like all of my suspense novels. This one has a little added element to it in that it has a love story in it as well. So it kind of combines a suspense novel with a little bit of a love story. And what you need to know, the setup is that in the very first chapter of the book, My main character is a guy named Nick Hansen, and he's 40 years old, and he's divorced. He goes into the grocery store one night, and he sees a young woman who is identical to his college girlfriend, except that his college girlfriend has been dead for 20 years. She died in a house fire when they were in college. So Nick goes up to the woman to say, hey, you must be related to this family I once knew. And when he approaches the girl and mentions the name of the family, the girl freaks out and runs away from him. So he feels even more depressed about the state of his life. To make matters worse, the next morning, the police knock on his door and they say, not only is that girl who you talked to in the grocery store dead, but she had your name and address in her pocket when we found her body. And what is the deal? So the book is basically about him figuring out who this girl is, why she looks so much like his college girlfriend, and did his college girlfriend, Marissa, really die the way he has always thought she died, or is there more to the story behind that?
Now, Nick is just an ordinary, average kind of guy that is, you know, kind of thrust into this situation where all of a sudden it could be anybody. It could be anybody like you or me seeing somebody that we thought had passed away, and then all of a sudden you're seeing them walking around. Now, the one thing that I was curious to know is this is, of course, 20 years later, but she looks like she did 20 years earlier.
Right. It's a young woman. Yeah. So he has all sorts of questions like, is she some kind of distant relative? At one point, he even wonders, is this my child? You know, that that when his girlfriend died, did she really die? And was it possible that she was pregnant at the time that he last saw her? She breaks up with him very abruptly right before she dies. So he's trying to – and he never got an answer to why she so suddenly dumped him when they were very much in love. So one reason might be to think she was pregnant. Is this child his? So a lot of those scenarios go through his mind as he's trying to piece together across 20 years – what is the connection between this girl and him, and why is she looking for him?
Yeah, he wasn't able to just kind of message her on Facebook, was he, and say, what's the deal? That wasn't around 20 years ago.
Right, you couldn't, you know. You also didn't have to deal, I guess, with the awkward, do you untag all the pictures and change your Facebook status and all that kind of stuff that we never had to worry about back then, and now these young kids have to worry about that.
Yeah, and you got to block the phone from your cell phone and all this other fun stuff, and it's like, oh, such a hassle. It was a lot easier, like, you know, 20 years ago, you just say, I'm out, you leave,
right,
and then that's it. That's it. You're done.
I'm so glad I've been married. I've been married the entire run of Facebook, basically, so I've never had to worry about it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, me too. I've never had to jump into that realm because it is craziness.
Yeah.
But when you're So when you're throwing an ordinary guy kind of into a circumstance that he's not familiar with, and it's a very emotionally charged book, when you sat down and you decided to create Nick Hansen, what type of character were you looking for in the story? Because it sounds like that you maybe had this idea first, and then you kind of thought of how the characters were going to kind of fit into the puzzle pieces that you needed to put together. So how were you able to think of Nick and think of what you wanted in a main character to be the lead of the story?
Well, I did want a guy who was relatively ordinary, you know, that he's a guy who gets in over his head, you know, kind of like the classic, you know, the man who knew too much. How does this guy end up in the middle of this thing where he may be dealing with unsavory characters and secrets from his past that he wasn't ready to deal with? So he's a fairly ordinary guy in that sense. And I also wanted to think, though, of a guy who, you know, like any character, he has to be motivated enough to go do things. And so the big motivating thing for him in this is his love for this woman who he lost 20 years earlier, that the desire to have the answers to those questions and to know that he finally knows the answers to everything that happened in the past is a big motivating factor. It's kind of, you know, it's loosely based on my own life, my own marriage. I just mentioned being married. My wife and I met when we were 20 and when we were in college, like Nick and Marissa in the book. And we dated for 2 years, and then we broke up after college because, you know, we were young and dumb, and we couldn't figure out how to get on the same page at that time in our life. So we broke up for several years, and then we got back together, and we figured it out, and we got married. But those years we were broken up, I often look back on, and I think, what if we had never gotten it squared away? Or what if something had happened to one of us during that time we were apart, and then we would have spent the next 20 years or 25 years or whatever thinking, I blew it. I had this thing, and I blew it, and my life could have been totally different. So I drew on that. And I think it's kind of just that scenario of, if I'd gone down one path, what would my life have been like? You know, instead I went down another path, and here's where my life is. So I had to think of a guy who had all of those emotions, all of those unresolved questions, and was interested enough and had this burning desire to go and find out and put himself in danger to find out what the heck is going on.
Did he surprise you throughout the book? Was there moments when he did things that even you kind of got surprised at what he was able to accomplish or do or handle certain situations that you threw at him?
Yeah, you know, I always start with an outline. Sometimes it's a really detailed outline. Sometimes it's a little less detailed. But I really like it when I'm writing something and something that is not in the outline, some turn of the story, something that the character does comes up and appears in my brain, and I say, well, that's the direction the story has to go. So there are several moments like that for Nick. I mean, he faces moments where he reaches dead ends, where everything seems to be explained as logically as possible. It seems like, and other people are saying to him, you know, let this go. You know, you've got all the answers. These things you're thinking, these scenarios you're imagining, they're ridiculous. They're not true. But every time he got to that point, every time he reached that dead end or that blind alley, he pushed through and he found another reason to keep going. And I think that's why I enjoyed writing about him, was because he was a guy, you know, no matter how many times he got knocked down, no matter how many times he got told no, he kept coming back for more until the end of the book when he does find out all of these things that are really going on.
Now, and you're an author that has not jumped into the series writing. Your books are, you know, your books are standalone. You know, your last one, The Forgotten Girl, Never Come Back, you know, on all the way to the first, you know, Cemetery Girl. Is there a reason why behind that you are drawn, I guess, more to the standalone style of writing than the popular, it seems like 85 to 90% of the books come out are all part of some kind of a series?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is that I haven't come up with a compelling enough reason to write a series. That, you know, I think if writing a series for an author has really high risk and really high reward. If you come up with an idea that's really compelling, or if you come up with a character who is really compelling, and that first book comes out and readers dive in, then you've got an audience that's going to keep coming back for more and more and more. You know, that's why people read Sue Grafton. That's why people read the Spencer novels, you know, on and on and on. If, however, you come up with an idea for a series and for whatever reason the reading public doesn't bite on the first one or the first couple ones and it doesn't get that traction, then the whole thing's kind of dead in the water and your plans to write a series, you know, hit the rocks and go ashore. So I haven't come up with an idea that I feel was compelling enough to take that risk. The other part of it is I just really enjoy, and my ideas seem to come to me in terms of standalones, that I come up with a scenario and I come up with these characters and I put them in a situation, and they go through a heck of a lot in those 400 pages of the book, and pretty much everything is resolved when you get to the end, and I kind of like that. Then when I start over with the next book, I can create a new set of characters with a new set of problems in a new location, and I can just kind of go from there. So I kind of like hitting the reset button and starting over again every time. It's not to say I'll never do it, or that I don't think about it way in the back of my mind, and it's not that readers don't write to me and say, hey, I'd love to know what happened after Cemetery Girl. I'd love to know. I've already had people saying, I'd love to know what happens next in somebody I used to know. So it's not that I don't think about it. It's not that people don't ask me about it. Mm-hmm. It just hasn't come to life yet.
Gotcha. And I think, you know, there's some authors, I think you like the challenge of knowing that you're in front, and I always say this, you know, knowing that you're in front of that blank canvas every time, you know, you don't have 30 or 40% of the book maybe already kind of written when you're doing series because you have the same characters moving forward. You're sitting in front of the blank canvas. They all have to be different. And I think that it creates a challenge that you're doing, like from Forgotten Girl to Somebody I Used to Know, was there something that you said, I'm going to challenge myself to do something a little different? Was this a little bit romantic than you have had in your past books that you wanted to challenge yourself in that realm? Or what was it? What was the one thing that you wanted to do in this book that was maybe a little different from previous books as you grow in, as a writer?
Well, I think the love story part of it was something that was a challenge to me. You know, in The Forgotten Girl, there is a love story in the sense that there's a married couple that is trying to figure out the course of their marriage. They've had some marriage troubles in the past, and through the course of the book, they're kind of reaffirming or reestablishing, yeah, we're going to be together. So that's kind of the course of the love story in The Forgotten Girl. This was something different. It was someone who had lost someone they loved very much in the past, and how does he come to grips with that and understand that? So, yeah, that was part of the challenge. You know, I always try to focus on the characters a lot in my books. And Somebody I Used to Know, the way the story kind of presented itself to me as I was thinking about it, it was really like from the very first page, the plot was really cooking. You know, it was like just stuff was just happening on every page. So I found myself focusing on the characters, but also I found the story was just like event after event after event. So I was trying to write a story where every chapter had a big question. Every chapter something was happening. So those were kind of the two things that came together for this book.
Now, we've talked social media, and a lot of social media has always come up in writing. And the one thing that I always find interesting is now when you write a book, and, you know, 20 years ago this never happened, so when you write a book now, you're able to see instant reaction from fans and from readers that maybe have found you and then they found you now. And you're able to see that right in forefront. They're posting on your page or they're emailing you and letting you know what they think, and you're hearing it. Do you ever let that affect you moving forward, maybe with the next book, because you maybe have a better understanding of what people are interested in and the kinds of things that they pick out of the book and maybe say, you know, this section was good, or I like this part or this part, and you're kind of like, interesting. And then maybe you kind of put those elements into your next book.
Well, I try to just focus on the positive comments that I get and the positive reviews that I get.
You mean you don't do Kevin O'Brien and kill off the, you know, Kevin O'Brien kills off the worst Amazon review that he has on his last book, and then dies in the next one?
I didn't know he did that. That's brilliant.
That's what he's
but
done.
No, I haven't done that. I haven't done that. You know, it's always interesting the emails that I get because honestly, you know, 99% of them are positive emails. If somebody goes to the trouble of writing to me, and I love it when people write to me with questions about the book or anything like that, and I love it, obviously any author loves it when someone writes to them and says, hey, I loved your book, I couldn't put it down, or whatever. But every once in a while someone will write to me just to tell me how much they didn't like the book. And I always think, like, I wonder about the thought process there of, like, I just wanted to tell you I hated your book. Like, I can't imagine doing that, but it happens. But my feeling is I kind of have to block all of that out, the good and the bad and the occasional bad and whatever, because I don't think I can chase after the audience. You know, just because somebody says, oh, I like this or I like that, you can't really chase after what people are saying. You can't really chase after publishing trends if, like, this year, you know, there are, like, 5 bestsellers about, somebody with a cat. You can't say, like, well, I'm going to write a book about somebody with a cat, because by the time the book you're writing comes out, you know, the cat thing is over. So
right.
I try not to worry about that too much. I just have to write what is interesting to me. And if it's interesting to me, I assume it will be interesting to other people. You know, I love reading thrillers and I love reading suspense novels. So if I enjoy it, then I have to figure somebody else is going to enjoy it. The only thing that, you know, hearing from readers it's a great boost. I think authors appreciate getting emails, the comments on Facebook, the comments on Twitter. I mean, how can it not make you thrilled if somebody writes to you and says, hey, I loved your book, or this is the best book I've read all year, or whatever. That's a thrill. So I love hearing that, but, you know, you can't really let it get too far into your head, I don't think.
Yeah, I think R.L. Stein had put it past one time, and you might have heard this story, he always tells it, is his best email that he ever gotten, or letter, I think, one of the two, was from a little kid. And he wrote him and said, dear Mr. Stein, I have read all your books and I hate them all.
Yeah.
He's like,
right.
Well, you keep reading them. So, no.
Right.
It's funny. But sometimes readers and fans have some very good, you know, some very good criticism. And I think that some authors either take that the wrong way, or they don't do well with bad reviews or negative reviews and things like that. But now you've been in this game for a while, and you know, you've seen some good, you've seen a lot of good, you've seen some bad. How much thick skin did you have to have early on when maybe you did get a negative review or something happens for you to be able to kind of overcome that and just keep moving forward? Because you can't please everybody. No matter what you write, you just cannot please everybody. It's just going to happen that way. But a lot of authors starting out would see something negative and then maybe they're like, well, I'm not going to do it anymore because I don't want to have to hear all that. How did you kind of get over that?
Well, I'm naturally just kind of a stubborn person because it's just like my parents are stubborn people, my siblings are stubborn people, naturally I kind of just have that in me. I'm a youngest child, so you know, I grew up in a family where I was smaller than everybody and put upon. I felt put upon as the youngest child. If you ask my siblings, they'd say I got away with everything. I felt like I got caught doing everything. So you know, I kind of felt like I grew up in a family of, you know, sarcastic people. So I felt like I kind of always had a thick skin, and I've been through a lot of workshops and I've been through a lot of that stuff, and I think you just kind of have to have that armor up. You just have to trust yourself and know that no one review is going to determine the course of your life. No one bad review or one amazing review is going to change your life. I think we all have a fantasy of like, oh, you know, if one person reviews it, you know, if the New York Times puts it here or the Washington Post reviews the book here, then I'm set for life. That's it. Mm-hmm. But none of those things are earth-shattering events in any way, shape, or form. My agent and my editor have been from the very beginning, and I've had the same agent and editor for these five books with Penguin, so I'm very lucky, have always said it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. You're playing the long game here. You're building a career that it's not about any one book necessarily, but right now people can go into a bookstore and there are five books with my name on them, and that's building a career. And so I never tried to get too high or low about any one thing. There have been times where I've freaked out about things, and if I talk to my agent on the phone or I talk to my editor or I talk to my wife Molly about it or whatever, then people talk me down from the ledge. You know, I can remember having these conversations with my agent where she said, it's a long game, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, just keep writing the book, keep focusing on what you're doing, and eventually these things will all work out and you'll look back and you'll have a career going. And she was right. And so I think any writer has to maintain that even keel and understand, you know, it's one review, one comment, one whatever isn't going to make or break you.
Right. I mean, you know, being an author is no different than being a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer. You have to go to school first and train, and then you have to become an intern, and then you have to go through a long process in order to finally be able to hone your craft and get your – but then you're always constantly learning. You know, you're still constantly learning, and you're still, you know, going on. So
it makes me glad that I'm not – you know, I watch the Olympics, and you'll see these gymnasts or somebody like that who have trained for 4 years, and they have, like, you know, 2 minutes to do their routine, and if they fall off the balance beam, they're never going to win a gold medal the rest of their lives, and they're, like, 16 years old. I'm so glad writing isn't like that. I'm so glad that that I'm not judged on, like, one chapter I write, you know, way back when. You know, it's like, this is a whole book, and you're building a readership, and so, it's much better that way.
Yeah, it'd be like reading the first chapter of Cemetery Girl saying, I don't get it. And then that's it. You're done.
That's it. See you later.
It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Now, for fans that are just finding out about you, like you said, now you have five books out and the latest, Somebody I Used to Know. So taking that one out of it, and fans come up and they say, hey, David, which is the best book should I start with you to maybe get an understanding of, you know, how you write and the kind of style that you write, to know who you are and then to be able to jump into the other four? Which one do you kind of point them to in the direction?
You know, it's always a tough question because they're all a little different in terms of the subject matter and in terms of who the protagonist is. People always say if you ask an author which book is your favorite, it's like asking somebody which is their favorite child, you know, and that kind of thing. So it's always tough for me to answer that. I guess I would point people just to start chronologically. I mean, if they're not going to read Somebody I Used to Know, Cemetery Girl is one that people really liked a lot. And it pretty much gives you a sense of what I'm all about as a writer. It's similar to Somebody I Used to Know, and they're all similar in the sense that they're regular people, they're families, they're dealing with extraordinary circumstances, they're faced with something unimaginable in the middle of their lives, their child disappears, and they have to try to keep their family together in the face of that. So to me, it's just kind of like, hey, read the back of the book and see which one sounds most interesting to you. I'd like to think I've gotten better as I've gone along, like you were saying earlier, that Somebody I Used to Know is a little better than the other ones, that they keep getting better and adding new wrinkles to them. So my advice is just read all of them. Read all of them.
Regardless of the order. Just pick
and then let me know which one you think is the best.
Is there a subject matter you will not touch regardless and ever? You just won't go there?
Not really. I mean, not really because, I mean, these books have all touched, you know, I've had children who have disappeared and children who have been murdered, Never Come Back, which was my third book with Penguin. And I'm not giving anything away. On the very first page of the book, the mother, the main character's mother, is murdered. And I dedicated that book to my mother. So I don't feel like there should be anything off limits to any writer. As long as when what we're writing about, when we're writing about these dark things, you know, violence and crimes being committed, I think we have a responsibility to be to depict it accurately, to say that there are consequences to the awful things that happen in the world. This is not like a video game or a TV show where, like, you know, the person gets shot and then, like, 5 minutes later they're fine or whatever, or somebody loses a family member and, like, 5 minutes later they're fine. I mean, I think we have a responsibility to show the consequences of these things and to not be gratuitous for the sake of being gratuitous. My books aren't particularly violent. You don't really see anything on the page. It's more the effect of what has happened on the characters. So I've never had anything that I've thought, no way, I would not do that. I think we have to be free to go where the story takes us, even if it does make the reader uncomfortable. In fact, I teach creative writing and I tell my students, your goal is to kind of make the reader uncomfortable. Even comedy makes the reader uncomfortable. Think about an episode of Seinfeld. Why do we laugh at Seinfeld? We laugh because they get into these ridiculous, awkward, uncomfortable situations, and we're watching it and we're thinking, well, thank God that's not me, who's in that situation. So a crime novel is kind of the same way. You want the reader to be uncomfortable and to be thinking about the effects of these awful things that happen in the world.
Well, we got about 30 seconds left, David, so I want to give you the last word to be able to let everybody know all your social media, website, best place to find you, and everything else. So do it up.
Yes. My website is davidbellnovels.com. I'm on Facebook, which is also David Bell Novels, Twitter, @DavidBellNovels, Instagram, David Bell Novels. Email me, david@davidbellnovels.com. I do love hearing from readers. I love interacting with readers on social media. And check it out for release dates and events and cover reveals and all that kind of fun stuff.
Well, David, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been a pleasure. You know what? You got 5 books out, and this is the first time you've been on. Well, let's not take so long the next time to have you come back on and speak with us. It's been great.
Okay, that's great, and I appreciate all the support you've given to my books, and it was great talking to you. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you, David. Enjoy and have a good one.
All right, take care.
All right, you too. So again, everybody, that is author David Bell, and go to davidbellnovels.com. Get the book, Somebody I Used to Know. It's definitely a book of suspense, thriller, little romance put in there. It's just one you got to have on your bookshelf. I mean, there's not really much more to say than just put it on your bookshelf, put it in your Kindle, and pick it up and read it. And if you haven't read David, you got 4 other ones that you can jump into outside of Somebody I Used to Know. So we want to thank all the guests for coming on today. Jeannie Ryan, we're sorry that Jax Miller was unable to call in. We're going to find out what's going on with that. And again, thank you to David Bell for being here and speaking with us. Check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com for more information on these and this show and all the other shows. Crime and Science Radio will join us next Saturday, where Hank Fuller P. Ryan will interview Doug Lyle. Story Blender will be on next Friday. And Jeff and I return on Monday. We got John Land, Shane Yerke, Robert Dugani, a bunch of other people coming up on Beyond the Cover, so check that out. So until next time, we want to say thanks and keep reading. Have a good one. Bye-bye, everybody.